The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, the talk station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I'm your host, John Johnston. As always, check out ballisticradio.com and facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening is, once again, absolutely no one. Jim and Andy have lives outside of the show, and I'm glad to hear they are doing well, but not here tonight. I do, however, have a very, very interesting gentleman with me, Mr. Greg Elifritz, who is the force behind active response training. He's also been an instructor at TDI, also a police officer up around Columbus. We're going to be talking about active shooters and going to try and take that a little bit different direction than what you usually hear as far as the self-indulgent fantasies that some people come up with when discussing this situation. But also, to make sure, and I mentioned this last show, but my friend Todd Green has started a charity, rampageforthecure.org. Go check that out. Donate some money. Like I said last time, any charity that references Archer is okay by me, and Todd's a good guy. So without further ado, Greg, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate you driving all the way down from Columbus. So we're doing something a little different, too. And I've tried not outlining the last couple shows, and I've found it to be a little bit more interesting, to say the least. So we did that again with this one. So we'll see where we go tonight. But for the listeners that are not familiar with your background, do you mind just giving us a little bit and we'll go from there?
Sure. I've been a police officer in a suburban agency, suburb of Columbus, for a little over the last 18 years. 13 of those years were spent as the full-time tactical training officer for the agency. So they sent me just about everywhere to get me certified in just about every type of police training imaginable, guns, empty hand combat, and everything else. And then I did all the in-service training for the department for 13 years. In addition to that, I've taught at Tactical Defense Institute since 2001. I'm lead instructor for several of their programs and have my own training company, Active Response Training. I've been doing that since 2004.
Okay, cool. So you're pretty well qualified to talk about tonight's subject. So
yeah, the active shooter has been a real passion of mine for a long time. So I've done a whole lot of research, published a whole lot of writings on that topic. So it's an interesting topic for
okay.
me.
So just for folks that might not be familiar, let's kind of define the active shooter problem. Now, the most recent example would obviously be the Navy Yard shooting.
Right.
Perhaps you could actually make an argument that the church shooting they had down a few days ago or last
yes.
week theoretically could be an active shooter just
Correct.
With not, you
just
know,
only one victim.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and that seems to be the distinction is the number of victims involved.
Sure. It seems to be, everyone defines this slightly differently, and so it depends on the study that you look at and who's doing what. But the general characteristics are this occurred in a public place. It involves multiple victims, and in general, at least some of the victims, the killer did not know. So
okay.
there's some element of randomness involved in this.
Okay. Another example would also be like the terrorist attack that they had in
Nairobi?
Yeah, I was going to say Kenya for some reason. I don't know
that
why.
Kenya.
Yeah, exactly. See, I just like to broaden everything. I can't refer to specifics for some reason. It's not in my brain. Anyway, another good example, too,
yes.
and that's a little different, too, because that was more of a terrorist act versus
Correct.
The act of, well, you can say that they're madmen, but the stated goal
sure.
was a little bit different.
Most of the people kind of classify these active killing events into three broad categories. You know, you have a single crazed gunman, mentally ill or not. You have a type of person that works in concert with someone else. If you look at like the Columbine style killers, where you've got two working together with a little bit more planning, and then you have kind of the terrorist hostage siege active shooters that are evidenced in Kenya, Beslan, for example, where you have a lot of people. You know, in Kenya, we're talking somewhere in the 15 range. Beslan, you're looking at about 20 different people with extensive amounts of planning. All of those can be classified as active killer events, but they have slightly different backgrounds and slightly different motivations.
Right. And we've been pretty lucky as far as in the U.S., at least, we've not seen as much coordinated attacks by, you know, whether or not you agree with their politics. For the most part, it's a military organization or military Correct. Style operation. We haven't seen as much of that in the U.S., thank God.
Right.
And hopefully we will continue to dodge that bullet. But, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. I was kind of just curious to get your thoughts. I guess the first thing we'll go over is a concealed, you know, I have a concealed handgun license, carry a gun 99.999% of the time. You hear a lot of gun people talk about these situations as far as what they would do or what they wouldn't do. And they don't necessarily think about some, in my mind, interesting aspects of that as far as whether or not they should engage in the first
sure.
place and,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do they not get shot by the responding officers if they do
right.
Tend to engage. Just, we'll start at the beginning. We've got about a minute and 40 seconds left. We're talking with Greg Elifritz from Active Response Training. In your mind, is there a go or no-go line for you, or do you have general advice as far as people's response?
I think people underestimate the danger that they're in this kind of a situation. Always the safest course of action is to use your own gun only when necessary to get yourself or your family out of the situation. That's going to be the safest action that you can do. And a lot of people don't consider that. Most of the people who have concealed carry licenses, who carry guns, they're good people and they want to be helpful. And they're in a place and time where that gun may be of assistance to someone greater than them. And they don't even consider just getting out of the situation rather than engaging. But engaging is a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. I would assume that whenever you voluntarily enter a gunfight, there are certain things to take into consideration. We'll get into that a little bit more. I'm just, you know, we got another 30 seconds left. You hear in gun circles the word sheepdog thrown around a bit. And I want to say you and I have talked about this on Facebook occasionally in the past, but do you think that term has been run with by people that don't necessarily understand the original meaning behind it?
I do. I think the general term, the idea behind the general term is to differentiate someone who's willing to protect society as a large, more than just him or herself. But I think overall it's kind of turned into a derogatory term used to disparage people that aren't necessarily deserving of that disparagement.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. When we get back, we'll talk with Greg Elifritz from Active Response Training about some of the problems that are involved with the active shooter scenario. But right now, you are listening to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station.
Be wealthy and wise. The Steve Perrin Coordinated Financial Planning Studios. This is 55KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. We are talking with Mr. Greg Elifritz right now from Active Response Training about active shooters and, in general, kind of the, not only active shooters, but just concealed handgun licensees having to utilize their firearm, some considerations. Now, before the show, Greg, we were sort of discussing what we were going to go over, and something that you kind of brought up that I don't think's, you know, really talked about enough, is how do you differentiate yourself from the, for lack of a better term, bad guy, so that when responding officers show up either to, you know, a mall shooting, if you're unlucky enough to be involved in one of those, or even just, you know, a street robbery gone bad, what are some things that should be considered?
I don't think many concealed carry licensees actually think through beyond the point of I shoot the bad guy. and
which is a stretch sometimes.
Yes. So. Some things that need to be thought about is one of the biggest things you're going to have to think about is you have to recognize that very quickly the police are going to be on the scene. Nothing brings the police faster than people shooting at each other. And you have to be prepared so that you aren't mistaken for the shooter when the police roll up.
Okay.
The other consideration is even before you shoot or as you are shooting, you have to realize that there might be off-duty cops, there might be other concealed carry licensees in the same venue that don't know what's going on that may mistakenly shoot you as well. So you have to be careful for those kind of things.
Well, and to be clear, too, and we kind of covered this in the first segment, but honestly, you know... Well, I'll get into this a little bit more, but the main idea is to get away from whatever the problem is. And sometimes the gun facilitates that, and sometimes the gun has absolutely nothing to do with it. And I think a problem that some people have is mistaking the gun as an answer for every situation they find themselves in. That having been said, if for whatever reason you are 100% aware of what situation is going on and you've made the decision that that firearm is necessary... Be sure of what's going on, I guess, number one. But, you know, what do you think? Holding people at gunpoint? I mean, do you find yourself doing that sort of thing if you're not a cop?
If you're talking about the active killer event where someone is shooting multiple times, I don't know that it's going to be a very successful outcome if you draw your weapon and threaten this person.
Didn't that actually happen in a mall? There was a mall shooting, I want to say, out west somewhere. Where
Trolley Square.
Was that what it was?
Yes.
And the guy challenged the shooter
That was a different, entirely different event, but yes, two similar outcomes.
And he got shot and paralyzed, I want to say,
correct.
Because he didn't just... shoot the guy.
Yes.
So.
But he did, and, you know, for what it's worth, that particular concealed carry licensee, he drew his weapon, he challenged a guy with a rifle in the mall. The guy with the rifle shot him, paralyzed him, but that forced the gunman to flee and then go around the corner and shoot himself. So, you know, one pattern that we see with most of these active killers is as soon as they experience effective resistance in any form, whether it comes from a person with a concealed carry license, whether it comes from an unarmed person tackling them or the cops arriving, they tend to either give up or shoot themselves. We don't see much resistance from them at that point.
Right, and that would be more of the emotionally unbalanced sort of individual. Now, when you look at guys like, you know, former Major Hassan or something like that, he didn't stop doing what he was doing until the female police officer paralyzed him with her sidearm.
It was actually, she hit him and he continued to fight. So she was actually, he hit her, she hit him. She was down, unable to move, and they both had gun malfunctions, both of them at the same time.
Nice.
She was on the ground trying to clear her malfunction. He was standing up trying to clear his so he could get another shot on her when he was shot by her coworker.
So
this is an example of one of those very aggressive people that, despite having been shot, continues the fight.
And that seems to be a little bit more. I know that was classified as workplace violence, but, you know, I can say I'm all sorts of things, and that doesn't make it true. I won't go there. The FBI is right next door. They might get mad at me. So I guess, what are some things that we can do to identify ourselves to police officers if we're forced to use a gun? Now, personally, I mean, my personal appearance, I don't necessarily look like a, for lack of a better term, good guy, at least most ideas of a good guy. I mean, any advice for me or, you know?
As the police roll up on the scene, they're going to be evaluating kind of the totality of the circumstance. So anything that you do that makes you look more like a good guy is going to be helpful. You know, it's tough because in the active shooter event, we don't have a set profile of what an active killer looks like. There hasn't been, it's so inconsistent with that cops tend to have fewer misconceptions, so appearance doesn't play quite as big of an issue. What's going to play the biggest issue is, do I have a gun in my hand or not? You know, and that's something that we really work with our students a lot on, is if you choose to engage in this event, we don't want to be running up to it with gun in hand. It's just, besides the killer potentially seeing you and shooting you there, you've got off-duty cops, you've got on-duty responding cops, you've got concealed carry permit holders, all seeing you running around with a gun when people are getting shot, and that could lead to you getting shot mistakenly. So keep that gun holstered until the last possible minute.
Okay, so until a shot presents itself that you're able to take, or
correct,
you have eyes on, line of sight, and all that.
That brings up another instance. You know, how many of you actually know how far you can guarantee this shot? You know, most of these things happen in crowded public areas. A miss in that environment is going to end up with someone you don't want to hit being hit. So knowing how close you have to be to that target to guarantee that hit is a useful thing to know. And if I'm 75 yards away from the shooter in a crowded mall and I can't make that 75-yard shot, I need to close the distance to get to a location where I know that I can make that shot.
Right, and that I was actually talking about that on the Facebook page a little earlier this week. We're talking with Greg Elifritz right now, Active Response Training, about mass killings, active shooters, and all that. Now, I know there was one example of an Air Force MP, security patrol officer, I want to say, that made a headshot on a guy at 75 yards with a Beretta M9 he had never shot before, which is impressive. But yes. You hear a lot of in the typical gunfight, it's going to be, you know, 21 feet or less and all that. Do you think that that's overplayed as far as the importance of what happens if you find yourself in a situation where you're not in the typical scenario?
Yes. Well, in the event of an active shooter or active killer event, that is by definition not the typical gunfight that
right.
you're going to get into. You know, more than 80% of these folks have long guns. They tend to have lots of extra ammunition, up to thousands of extra rounds of ammunition. And we're seeing a greater and greater increase in the likelihood that these folks are wearing some type of body armor or protective garment.
Okay.
You know, if you're a street robbery, you know, where you've got a criminal with a malfunctioning or unloaded gun half of the time at, you know, 3 feet away is a different scenario than fighting one or more people armed with long guns, lots of ammunition, friends, and body armor.
Right. And that that brings up an interesting point, too. You've seen, or at least I see or hear a lot of people that talk about, you know, having a long gun in their vehicle or something like that, or even, you know, plates, armor plates, plate carriers, things like that.
Sure.
Now, I used to kind of scoff at that, and I still do for the most part, even though I kind of am one of those people, because I make fun of myself, and anyone that listens to the show knows that. But, you know, as you see more things like the Nairobi shooting and you know, even the Navy Yard shooting, do you think that long guns are something that should be considered a little bit more, or?
I think they can be. They should be considered. I can't rule them out. If you look at what happened in Nairobi, we had at least one former soldier that made multiple trips in and out of the mall, engaging terrorists and getting people to safety, who had an opportunity to, you know, potentially reach a car with a long gun, body armor there. But if you look at the statistics of what tends to happen domestically in the United States, it tends to be an event that is over no longer than 6 minutes, and most of them are significantly under that. If we factor in all of the events, the average is about 6 minutes, but that includes the longer-term events like Columbine and that kind of thing. When you factor in the ones that are average, if you can say that there is an average, it's over in 4 minutes or less. So I see a lot of my students who talk about, you know, I carry a J-frame 38 in my pocket, but if I get involved in a mall shooting, I'm going to run out to my car, grab my AR-15 and my body armor plates, and I'm going to go back in and engage. And in all reality, that isn't likely to happen. It's going to be over by the time you do that. This is a come-as-you-are event, and you're going to have to deal with it with whatever you've got on your person, most likely.
Right. And, you know, we have a lot of back and forth on the show with with people that are either proponents of, you know, the small guns or the larger. I carry a full-size service pistol, but that's because it's pretty comfortable for me to do so. You know, it kind of, I see the point where, like you said, in a street robbery, it doesn't always matter that much what you have necessarily. Right. But if you find yourself in one of those non-typical engagements, it becomes sort of important. You know, going back a little bit more to how to, you know, identify ourselves as good guys if we're in a situation, you know, whether it's a convenience store robbery or a mall shooting or something like that, and we got about 35 seconds or so. Other than, you know, don't draw the firearm until you absolutely need to use the firearm, what are some other things that we should think about?
Along that same line is if you do need to engage, if you do need to shoot, as soon as you're sure that the threat is down, that there's no more possibility of resistance, get your weapon holstered. You don't want to be standing over a downed criminal with a gun in your hand when the cops arrive. They're going to be amped up. They're going to be looking for someone with a gun. You don't want to be having that profile. So something people don't consider is just holster. You can keep your hand on your gun if you need to re-engage, but get that gun out of the line of sight very, very quickly.
Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, and there were some other things that you brought up that I found interesting. When we get back, some more suggestions from Greg Elifritz about how we should conduct ourselves if we find we've entered into a area being shot up by someone that's not quite right in the head. But right now, you are listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Hey, it's Brian Thomas. Monday in the morning show. It is Monday morning spleen vent. Be around 7:05. We'll see what's gotten underneath my dad's skin. 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Right now, we are talking with Greg Elifritz from Active Response Training. We were having an interesting conversation about how quickly I would move or not move and whether or not it would be my flip-flops' fault, at least during the commercial break. But hey, anyway, if you have any questions or you want to discuss this with us, you can give us a call, 513-749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. No one on the line right now, so we'll probably get to your call at the end of the show. Even if it's not about the active shooting thing, if you have another question, I can try and answer it for you towards the end of the show, like I said. But anyway, so back to what we were talking about, and for those that were curious, we were just discussing whether or not people would be able to run to their car, retrieve a rifle, whatever, and then run back into the mall or wherever, and most of the times, no. But anyway, so
some other things that some people should be probably considering there so that they don't get shot by responding cops or shot by other concealed carry licensees. We talk about cover a lot, but something that we think about that you may not think about is not only do I want to seek cover from the down bad guy and any of his friends, but I also want to seek cover from responding officers. Anything that I can do that can slow things down a little bit, and if I can get behind cover when the cops get there, that's going to reduce the chance that I'm going to get shot. So don't think just cover from the bad guys. Think cover from the responding officers as well. They're going to be amped up. Officers have differing levels of training and differing personalities. And, you know, some are going to be calm and in control of the situation and handle things professionally. But you might get the cop that is his first day on the street, never responded to a shooting in his life, and he's all amped up, and he's worried that he's going to get killed, and he sees a guy with a gun in his hand, and he makes a mistake. So we want to make sure that we get a little cover from them.
Yeah, and being mistakenly shot by the good guys is, I would assume, a pretty bad day.
No, I would think so. I would think so.
Never happened to me, but, you know.
Some other things you got to think about in this scenario is I have a lot of my students who start yelling immediately after shooting. I have a concealed carry permit, or even my police students. I'm a police officer. And they tend to forget that in an event like this, with the gunshots going off, sometimes people don't hear things so well. And that verbal explanation might not be good enough. Besides that, You know, we've all heard of the situation, you know, went under extreme stress and a lot of adrenaline, the tunnel vision that happens where the body tends to focus all of its efforts on processing information from the dominant sensory input that guarantees survival. And for most situations like that, it's going to be eyesight. So you hear people report in very stressful situations that they didn't hear things that were said just because the body isn't processing that information. So you yelling out, I have a concealed carry license, or I'm a cop, that may not be enough to get you to save you from being shot by those responding officers.
Well, and I've actually personally known people, you know, the auditory exclusion thing, you hear people talk about that and some people discount it. But in my experience and the people, you know, other people that I've talked to and all that, that's a very real thing as far as you don't even know.
It sure is.
You don't even hear the gun go off, which is surprising to some people. We've got Mike in Columbus holding on the line right now. Mike, I'm going to get to your call in a minute. I want to go over a couple more things with Greg first. You know, something else, and I kind of wanted to get your opinion on this. I had someone ask me about the concealed carry holder badge.
Sure.
That there's a company or two that makes those. I'm personally vehemently opposed to those, and I think they're kind of, and no offense to the people that make them, and that's fine. People can buy whatever they want to buy, but for me personally, not a big fan of those. What are your take on that?
I agree. I don't think it's a real good idea for most of the time. You know, I think the only utility that those have are in a, you know, in a state that might have a brandishing law or something that requires guns be concealed, you know, and you accidentally flash your gun as you're pulling your wallet out. If people see a badge next to it, they're less likely to call the cops. But in an active killer scenario like this, you know, there have been several law enforcement studies about how responding cops to shootings fail to see police badges when off-duty officers use it and accidentally shoot their fellow officers because they didn't see the badge. So the idea that they're going to pick up a badge on your belt that says concealed carry permit holder and not shoot you, I don't think that that's a realistic expectation.
Right. And since we live in a state where open carry is legal and since the states around us, open carry is legal, not much use for those if you're listening to the sound of my voice and it's not on the web.
I agree.
Yeah, anyway. We'll take Mike's call real quick. He's got a question or a comment about police response time, so let's see what he has to say. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's actually Mike Newbern from Students for Concealed Carry.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
It's going pretty good, going pretty good. How you doing, Greg? We've been in touch on Facebook a few times, and I'm actually working on a thing we talked about right now. So.
Excellent. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, well, anyway, back to my question. I'm curious about what you know on average response times to active shooter scenarios and what kind of hard data is out there on those types of things, and what are the differences in places where there's a higher police presence at a college campus versus just random city streets?
There's actually some, there's little hard data, but there is actually some hard data. There's a book that was recently published called Active Shooter Events and Response, where the author, primary author's last name is Blair, studied that pretty much in depth. And he determined that through the last 5 or 6 years of active killer events that he studied in the United States, the average response time, police response time, was 3 minutes. However, that response time is the response time from the time that the cops get the call until they arrive on scene. That doesn't include the time that it takes for the call to be made. It also doesn't include the time that the officers have to take finding and neutralizing the killer, which could easily double, triple, or quadruple that 3 minute time frame. If you're looking at a more rural area, you know, I have friends that are deputy sheriffs in rural counties, you know, they might only have two deputies out in an entire county in a nighttime situation, and you might get one cop there in 20 minutes and another cop there, the second cop there in 45. The response time could be excessively long in those kind of events.
Yeah.
But the 3 minutes is the average that we're looking at. And in a place, you know, rural, you're saying a little bit more. But in a place like, say, I don't know, let's pick any college campus in the United States, Ohio State, for example,
sure.
where there's a really high police presence, does the data indicate that that response time is less than, considerably less than 3 minutes? Or are we still
No, you're still looking at about that 3 minute response time. I'm really familiar with Ohio State University as an example, and I would say they're in the 3 to 4 minutes as most of the, you know, the major agencies in Columbus. What starts happening, what starts being a factor in this event is how the police are trained to handle this. And there's two differing schools of thought on this. And one is the first officer that gets there immediately goes, tries to find the shooter and engage him. You know, and if you've got a 3 minute response time with the first officer going after the shooter, that solves the problem pretty quickly. But other agencies teach to amass a group of 3, 4, or 5 officers before making entry. And almost all the situations, you know, in any metro area, you're going to get a cop there within 3 or 4 minutes. But it might take 10 minutes to get 5 cops there. And that's where we start having some problems.
Well, and interestingly enough, I just pulled up one of my outlines from a show I did previously. And this is Cincinnati. Just, you know, so different. We're not talking Ohio State or anything like that, but these numbers are from, I want to say, November of 2012, so they might be different by now. But quickest response in District 1 on average was 12 minutes and 47 seconds, and District 3 was 26 minutes and 20 seconds. Now, in fairness, that was an average of all calls, so we're not talking shooting calls or anything like that, but I think, and I'm sure that you would agree with me as well, Mike, the thing is the cops are never going to be there quick enough. I mean,
three minutes is a long time to be in a gunfight. I've never been in one before, but I can imagine 3 minutes is much longer than I ever want to be in one.
Take a look at what happened in Virginia Tech. If you look at the rate of injuries in that environment, you're looking at approximately 7 people shot a minute at Virginia Tech. You know, the Batman movie shooting was even faster than that. But, you know, 3 minutes means 21 more victims. That's a lot of people hurt in that, you know, very quick response time.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, do you mind if I throw you on hold real quick? And I'll get you back on the line if you have another question here. We got to go to break.
In the same line, but yeah, I'll hold.
Okay. We'll get you right back on the air. And we'll talk with Greg Elifritz a little bit more about that. Also, hear Mike's next question. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Glenn Beck.
This will blow your mind.
Tomorrow at 9:06 on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station. Brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. So we are talking with Mr. Greg Elifritz, and we actually have Mike Newburn from Students for Concealed Carry on the line with another question. Just a quick reminder, if you would like to call in and ask us something, you can get a hold of us at 513-749-5500, or if you're out of the area, 1-800-823-8255. Got an open spot or two on the line for those that would like to talk. But let's get back to... Hey, Mike, are you still there?
Yes, sir, I sure am. So last question for Greg, and then I'll let him talk to some other folks. you mentioned Colorado, you know, the Batman movie theater, and that is something that we point to in Students for Concealed Carry as an example of where police don't enter into an active shooter situation. Police were actually there before the shooting started as security, and all they did was usher people out, and the shooting didn't stop until his firearm malfunctioned, and he actually walked out the back door into the hands of police officers. Are you seeing a change in the way departments do things and their willingness to actively engage those
sure.
types of threats?
I am seeing a change, but it's been pretty slow. What you got to look at is the initial tactics, this teaming up, getting 3, 4, 5, 6 officers and going after the shooter. That's a direct response to Columbine. It's a situation where we had multiple shooters who were laying in ambush, who had explosive devices, and to safely handle that kind of environment, we need more than one cop. Since then, we have not had any domestically, any situations that have been like that. No one's been laying in wait. We haven't had any multiple shooters. We haven't had any ambushes. So the current state-of-the-art thinking is that each officer, as they get to the scene, should independently make entry. They can link up once inside if they run into each other, but each officer should quickly go in by themselves and handle the problem. But it's kind of slow to spread. But I would say that that is the current state-of-the-art as it results from law enforcement training, but not everyone is fully on board with it yet, as you saw in Colorado.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much for answering your questions. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Mike. I'll talk to you later. I appreciate hearing from you.
So, yeah. Have a good day.
Well. Hey, have a good night. So, and one other thing that I wanted to mention real quick that I meant to bring up, and then we've got a couple other callers on the line. If you've got someone that is with you, and as you're exiting or as you're making whatever decision, having them call in and give a description of you.
Really important. Now, you got to recognize that in any active killer event, you're going to get lots of calls into the police, and there's going to be lots of information broadcast to the responding officers. Some of it's going to be correct, some of it's not going to be correct. But if you have a spouse or a family member who can call the police and say, my husband, wife, whatever, is going back in after the killer, he has a concealed carry permit, and it's a 40-year-old white male wearing a plaid shirt, and he's one of the good guys, that information is going to get aired to the responding officers. There's going to be a whole bunch of other information aired as well, but any time that we can get the officers thinking that, hey, there's a good guy with a gun as well, that's going to slow them down as far as them firing as soon as they see someone with a gun. So train your family members, train your spouse that their role, if they aren't carrying a gun in this event, is to get on the phone to police very quickly and give your description to the responding officer so that you don't get shot.
And that seems, I mean, that seems like such a simple thing that people don't, you know, think through. Honestly, I'd personally like to see police training and doctrine reflect that anyone that wears flip-flops must be a good guy. So, you know, but
only on the beach.
Oh, hey, I guess I'm kind of weird. Anyway, we've got three people on the line. I'm going to try and bust through their calls real quick in the order they were received. So we have Matthew from Cincinnati has a caliber question, which I will try and deal with quickly. Matthew, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good.
What can I help you with?
Yes, I'm brand new to the guns, and when I first was shopping for a gun at Bass Pro Shop, an ex-cop and one of the employees actually almost got into it over which one I should get. And I basically wanted to know what would be a good – see, I have a 380 now, but just to let people out there know that was confused like I was, what is a good caliber to get? Because most people always told me, go bigger, go bigger, go bigger. I'm a small guy, about 5'5", about 200 pounds, and I can't carry a 40 or 44 size 45 on my waist.
Well, honestly, and Grave got some research that I'll post a link to on the Facebook page just so I can get to everyone's calls. But, you know, really, if you have a gun on you, in 99% of any situation you find yourself in, the caliber is not going to become important at all. A lot of the discussion on caliber is going to revolve around, you know, military or police engagements where they are dealing with someone that they have either cornered or have hunted down specifically and are getting in a protracted gun battle with. That having been said, I don't like 380 very much. I prefer 9mm. That's what I use all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, with a good belt and a good holster, I don't see why you couldn't carry a 9mm. But if all you got is a 380 and you've already spent the money on it, I wouldn't worry about it too much. I would just concentrate on more training. More training, more practice.
I would agree. Okay. When you talk about the rounds, there isn't a real problem stopping power with regard to the 380. The problem comes into the reliability of most of the guns that you're going to see and the accuracy and your ability to hit anything with the smaller gun. Like John, I'd really recommend a 9mm for most people.
So, hope that helped you out, Matthew. I appreciate you calling in tonight. Thanks for listening.
Definitely, dear. Thank you.
Hey, enjoy the rest of your Sunday. So we'll move right along. We got about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to try and burn through these as quick as I can. We've got Rick from Dallas, Texas. Rick, thanks for listening all the way from Texas. What can I help you with tonight?
Well, How you doing, guys? I was going to bring up a real off the beat topic. It has to be listening, but I think I'll stick to moral point. Do you hear about that incident in some city? They showed it all on the network TV where the guy pulled a gun and he squeezed the trigger two or three times. It didn't go off, thank God. I mean, the bad guy. And he went outside and went off. And there was a bottle behind that story, I think. He probably was using a semi-auto. You can kind of pass on the word. If people are going to buy those things, don't buy cheap ones. And don't buy used ones. You know, stick to Berettas or Smith & Wesson. Don't buy no Rugers or no junk like that, right?
Well, Ruger's okay. Here's what I'll say real quick, and then I'm going to get to the next caller. Any gun that you buy, I buy used guns all the time. It's not that big of a deal. But anything that you're going to carry and you're going to trust your life to, you want to shoot before you do that. Most of the criminals that are getting guns or stealing them off of people have no idea what bullets they take, just don't even know whether or not they're loaded, and that's when you see stuff like that. But, hey, Rick, I really appreciate you listening all the way from Texas and calling in tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, thanks. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. So we've got Richard from the West Side. Richard, I'm trying to get Richard on, and it's not letting me. Apparently I've managed to kill the phone. Let's try this. Hey, Eric, can you get Richard on the line for me, please?
Hello.
Hey, Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank Eric, the producer, for being awesome and getting you on the line. So, what can I help you with, Richard? We've only got another minute or two left.
You know, a lot of most companies have no gun zones, and I know in our company, which is one of the larger corporations in the United States. They not only do that, but they show this video where people are supposed to hide under their desk, which I don't have much faith in. But first of all, I'm a blue-collar worker, and we don't have a desk to hide under,
right.
which I wouldn't think that was the answer at all. I know, is there any way that we're talking about a majority of people in the United States that have are all on no gun zones,
sure,
that are really venerable.
What does a person that isn't armed do in that scenario? If you look at all of the active killer events that I've studied, you know, the quickest resolution is a person with a gun firing on the killer. Absent that, I don't think hiding under desk is a good answer. The best response that I see successfully employed is getting out of the area. As soon as you hear gunfire, get out of the building in the opposite direction of the gunfire. Those people tend to do well. After that, barricading yourself into a place that has good locks that make it difficult for the guy to get in, that's probably second best. And hiding is way down on the list. It hasn't been a very successful option in events in the past.
What is the choice of employees to try to convince employers that this no gun zone is a disaster?
There you go.
Well, I mean, yeah, and that's all you can do is trying to talk to your higher ups. You know, also too, keep in mind there is a big difference in states between whether or not a no gun sign is enforceable by law, or if it's just something where you're going to get fired, and then you get to make the decision as what's more important to you. But, hey, Richard, I appreciate you calling in. Billy, I'll get to your call after the show is over off the air. So, anyway, Greg, thanks for coming in tonight. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a really quick show. So, next week we're going to be talking with Rob Pincus, who is a sometimes controversial member of the firearms community. He is the head of ICE Firearms Training Services. We're going to talk with him about some of the ideas that he has behind his combat focus method and also some of the other things that he's come up with that I think are interesting. So it should be a cool show. Everyone, thanks for listening. Make sure you check out ballisticradio.com and facebook.com/ballisticradio. And make sure you tune in to us next Sunday at 7 p.m. on 55 KRC, the talk station. Be safe.